This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Governor Baker is responding today to critics who say Massachusetts' vaccine rollout hasn't been good enough. Here he is at a news conference this afternoon.
Well, keep in mind that we said at the beginning of this process that we were going to be slow out of the gate because we were focused on some hard-to-reach populations.
The governor faces mounting pressure to create a centralized vaccine sign-up system. Yesterday, 10 members of the Massachusetts congressional delegation sent Baker a letter urging him to do just that. And joining us is one of the lawmakers who signed that letter, Senator Elizabeth Warren. Senator, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's good to be here with you.
Well, we're glad to have you. And so just to start off, why did you and your colleagues feel that that letter to the governor was necessary? And what did you make of his response today?
People are feeling really frustrated all around Massachusetts. I mean, this has been a very slow rollout, and a rollout that has just a lot of aggravation attached to it. People aren't sure. They hear a rumor. Maybe it's over there. Maybe they could get vaccines someplace else. The rules seem to change. And one of the things you can do is you can get one centralized place where anybody can log on, get all the information, and make an appointment. Why not make it easier for people? And then people know, okay, my appointment is next Tuesday, I can go, or mine's a week from Thursday, and I can go. This idea of people to get these things down through multiple levels leaves a lot of folks behind and just ups everybody's degree of anxiety over this. There's just no point in it. Let's have a better rollout. We're Massachusetts.
So we'll see if the governor takes that advice. But in the meantime, he's on the defensive. And I want to play a little bit more of the way he explained the slow rollout. As we heard at the top, he attributes it in part to focusing on hard-to-reach populations. And he elaborated on that.
I mean, I can get plenty of people from the mental health and developmental disability and homeless community here, and we could line them up from one end of this room to the other, and they would tell you why they were both surprised and relieved and grateful that one state chose to put those folks at the head of the line. That didn't happen hardly anywhere else.
So, Senator, I mean, does that explanation make you cut the governor any more slack? And I'll point out, too, that the CDC says we actually now rank in the top 10 for vaccinations per capita.
Well, finally, we are moving up. I also remember when we were 47th out of 50, and West Virginia was number one. But I think the real point is, look, I think that there are a lot of hard choices to make when the vaccines are limited. And I think the governor has made good decisions to try to make sure that these vaccines are equitably distributed and that they go to hard-to-reach communities. But that still doesn't explain why we weren't using the vaccines that were allocated to us, why we weren't moving them through the system fast. You know, it's possible to do both, to reach hard-to-reach communities and to set up centers where those vaccines are going out the door and going out the door as fast as people can line up for them. And that's what we need to do. I just can't overstate the urgency of these vaccines moving quickly out to people so people can get vaccinated. Every single day that goes by, that some number of people are not using those vaccines that are sitting in storage here in Massachusetts is a day that somebody gets sick, and somebody can harbor the next version of the mutation of this virus that causes a whole lot more people to get sick. We need to move these vaccines faster.
Sure. And we know there's a lot of overlap between the rollout coming from Beacon Hill and what goes on in Washington. So I do want to get to the COVID relief bill that you and your colleagues are working on now. And some news from last night is that President Biden says that he's actually more open to a gradual increase of the minimum wage provision. This is one of the extra things that he is hoping to put into his $1.9 trillion stimulus bill. He would raise the wage to $15 an hour by 2025. I'm wondering if you're open to negotiations over how much or how gradually to raise the minimum wage.
Right now, I want to start with I want to underline, we need a $15 an hour minimum wage. And one place I've really focused is getting that wage in place right now for essential workers. Think about all the people who are stocking grocery store shelves and making deliveries and mopping floors. so that we can keep our healthcare system working, so that we can keep our food supply chain working, so that we can keep our economy up and running. Those people deserve a living wage. And a $15 an hour minimum wage across the board is going to help not only lift millions of families out of poverty, it's also going to help boost our economy overall. So right now, I just want to make clear, I'm going to be putting a big push on for that $15 an hour minimum wage. It's long past time that we should put a wage in place that someone who's out there working full time could actually support themselves and their family.
If I may, though, Senator, I'm wondering, do you think you can get there not only with Republican colleagues, but within your own party? Because some moderate Democrats, Joe Manchin of West Virginia comes to mind, has at the very least expressed some skepticism about raising the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. And you have no margin for error with even the budget reconciliation process, which would allow for passage on a party line vote.
I understand that we will have a lot of discussions about this as we go forward. And nobody gets exactly the big combined bill that they want. There are going to be things I want that I'm not going to get. There are going to be things other people want that they don't get. But I'll tell you this, I'm in this fight to defend a $15 an hour minimum wage. It is the right thing to do for our economy. It is the right thing to do for our families.
And this debate about what should be in the COVID relief package now can really take the full spotlight because we've moved past the second impeachment trial of former President Donald Trump. But I do want to ask you just a little bit about that, Senator, because the acquittal, of course, came over the weekend. It was a pretty quick trial. And I'm wondering now, looking back, whether you feel it was still a worthwhile and necessary use of time as this new administration was trying to get up and running.
The Republicans have to take responsibility for the fact that they were willing to let Donald Trump foment an insurrection, call people to Washington, and then whip this crowd up and send them down to the Capitol to break into the Capitol, ultimately resulting in the deaths of Americans. And the Republicans don't want to hold him accountable. That doesn't make it wrong for us to have put that case on and to put it out there in full view of the American people, in full view of the entire world, and in full view of history. It was the right thing to do to hold that trial. And if the Republicans were willing to let Donald Trump go on that, then that's on their heads and they will be judged by history.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit more about money then, because that's going to be a big area for you. Now you've joined the Senate Finance Committee. Congratulations on that.
What are your
priorities in that new role? I understand one could be introducing the wealth tax that you campaigned on.
Yes. You know, the whole idea behind this, let me just tell everyone in case anyone doesn't know the details of it, is to say that people who have more than $50 million in assets should pay a 2-cent tax on the amount above $50 million. In other words, your first $50 million is free and clear, but the 50 millionth and first dollar, you put in 2 cents, and 2 cents on every dollar over that. When you get in to $1 billion in assets, you put a few pennies more than that in. Frankly, it's just like a property tax that every homeowner pays, and frankly, every renter pays indirectly through their rent. Only the difference is for the top 0.1% in America, the tippy top economically, it says it's not just your real estate taxes, it's also taxes on your stock portfolio, the diamonds, the Rembrandt, the yacht, paying a property tax that then helps equalize just a little bit and finance opportunity for everyone else in this country.
The pushback I imagine you would get from that billionaire class, though, Senator, might be, you know, isn't this sort of a double tax? I paid taxes on the income when I first made it, and then I used that already taxed income to buy the Rembrandt and the yacht that you just mentioned, and now you want to tax those assets again once I own them. What do you say to that?
We do tax real estate. We already do this. We tax property. We have property taxes in America already. But do keep in mind that teeny tiny billionaire class that you're talking about there, right now, they're not paying a lot in taxes. So the 99% in America, they pay about 7.2% of their total wealth in taxes last year. That top one-tenth of 1% paid about 3.2%. So you add a couple of pennies, 4 pennies to it, they're still not paying as much as everyone else is. And frankly, that's just not right.
Well, let me ask you then about some recent headlines for investors who maybe imagine themselves joining that 50 million plus class. I'm talking, of course, about the GameStop frenzy. And you today publicized a letter that you received from Robinhood, which is the online trading platform at the center of that dramatic surge in the price of GameStop stock last month. And you had some questions about whether individual investors were adequately protected. And you say many of those questions remain unanswered. The idea, of course, behind Robinhood, as the literary reference suggests, is to make stock trading accessible to the masses, which could be good. Mm-hmm. But in this GameStop frenzy, some people who didn't really know what they were doing bought stock that was way overvalued, and now they've lost money, Senator. So my question is, how do we democratize investing in a responsible way?
So you put it exactly the right way. I want to see what are called retail investors, right? Folks who want to make investments in the stock market, I want to see them have access to that market, but I want to make sure it's a level playing field. So they shouldn't be in a position, for example, where the hedge funds can come in and play, but if things really heat up, somehow the private individuals get cut out. That's what happened, as you know, in the GameStop case. The market has become far too much a place that is not about bringing capital together so you can invest in businesses. Instead, it's become a place that's just a casino, and people come in and gamble. And let's face it, a casino is a place where the insiders, the folks who have that inside track, the big boys, repeatedly win, and everybody else gets left behind. And
yeah, I've heard that analogy, right? That for people who were trying to stick it to the short sellers by driving up the Robinhood price, it was sort of like trying to stick it to a casino by playing blackjack over and over. That you really, when you play against
over
the house,
and over and over,
you're liable to use.
Yeah.
I do want to try to squeeze in, Senator, while we have you, one more finance issue that I know is close to your heart, and that's college debt relief. I know you're working on trying to pass $50,000 in debt relief for college students or former students, as the case may be. And I'm curious why that's the focus, maybe even more so than bringing down the cost of college itself. I know that that is also on your agenda, but if we pass debt relief without getting the cost of college under control, won't we be in this same position just a few years down the line?
Yes, it is both. We must do both. We need to deal with the accumulated debt, and we need to make college debt-free. And we need both of those simultaneously. One of them we can do right now through executive orders, effectively, and that is the President of the United States, his administration, has the power to cancel $50,000 in student loan debt. And that would be the single most effective move the president could make to jumpstart our economy, and the single most effective move the president could make to help close the black-white wealth gap among the millions of people who have student loan debt, and the single most effective move the president could make to help give young people who are dealing with an economy that has turned against them a real start in life. So I want to see us go forward with this right now because we can. And as well, we need to follow through with debt-free college for all of our kids. We need to invest in an education and opportunity for the future.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt that the debt is crushing many students and former students. But I am mindful, though, Senator, that, you know, on the campaign trail, you often said that people who work hard and play by the rules should be able to get ahead. And so I'm imagining some listeners saying, well, hey, I mean, I worked hard to go to college and I played by the rules when I paid back the money I borrowed. And now you're saying my peers who didn't should have their student loans forgiven. So it doesn't feel like working hard and playing by the rules is going to help me get ahead after all. And that just doesn't seem fair. I mean, what do you say to those people?
There are multiple pieces, but let me just remind you, there are 43 million people in this country who are dealing with student loan debt right now. 40% of them don't have a college diploma. And they are disproportionately African-American, disproportionately Latino, disproportionately come from families that just couldn't afford to write a check to pay for tuition. There's also an element about this to remember. Canceling student loan debt would be really good for the 43 million Americans who get their student loan debt canceled, or at least a big chunk of it canceled. But it also would be good for everybody who doesn't have student loan debt because of its effect on the economy overall. The data have shown us well before the pandemic that people with student loan debt are not moving out of mom's house at the rates we would otherwise expect. They're not buying homes at the rate we would otherwise expect. And here's one. They're not starting small businesses. When you've got student loan debt, you can't just say, okay, I'm going to give it a big try here and I'm going to live on ramen noodles for, you know, 6 months and pitch in with my roommates. No, you've got to make that student loan debt payment every month. The consequence of those decisions that are driven by debt hold back our economy overall. And so in the same way that taxes I pay get used to pave roads in South Dakota, even though I haven't driven on any roads in South Dakota recently, we nonetheless make that investment because it's good for our whole economy. Good to have a transportation system that works for everyone. Good to have an education system that works for everyone. And step one in that, let's cancel out a big chunk of the student loan debt. Let's turn people loose from that and let them get out there and start their businesses and buy homes and save up and build a real future.
That's Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. Senator Warren, thanks as always for joining us, and we hope that you'll come back again soon.
You bet. It's always good to be with you.